the Bible and other things argue and pile up evidence that the timeline is really short. And so, in fact, we consider this, is that for the differences between when dinosaurs supposedly died off and man came into being, where's the evidence for the gap? It's all speculation. I mean, and the longer we go, the more years they keep adding to it. When I first started looking at this stuff in 1970s or whatever, the chart said there was like a million years before, between when the dinosaurs died off and when man came along. Now we're up to 60 million. But, where did the numbers come from? What did they use to find the million? Now they're using to find this 60 million. There's really nothing. It's all speculation. In fact, one of the things, I'm going to inject it here because I can't remember where I was going to inject it in the talk. One of the things that is very popular is the little trilobite. It looks like a silverfish, only exploded up, a lot bigger. Supposedly that was the beginning of dinosaurs or life itself, whatever. And just recently they went through some digs and found trilobites with man's handprints and footprints in them, in the fossils. So there's no difference between when the trilobite lived and when man lived. But we're going to look at some other things too. In fact, I put out the handouts a little bit late, so you may not have them. You can pick them up your way out. There's more on the overhead than there is in the handouts, plus pictures. So you may just want to look, facing forward and not looking down so much. We're starting off in Genesis 1, where it said, God made the beasts of the earth and all after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the earth after its kind. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over all the earth. So last week we looked at other passages showing that God made man in his image. Man was created, didn't just form. And that the animals, roughly on the same day, all the animals, everything that flew, creeped, what, swam, whatever, was made contemporary with man. Not much difference in days. Man was given dominion over them. In fact, we're going to look a little closer at some of this stuff. Truly, dinosaurs were remarkable creatures. Some were extremely large. Others were smaller, with sharp teeth and long claws. Some had big heads. Some had giant tails, and some had both. Others were covered with spikes or armored plates. People in general seemed to think of them as being almost invincible animals that lived during a time which man simply could not survive. We looked at that last week. A little bit more we're going to look at this week, showing that man could tame anything. In fact, that's what James says, that man has tamed everything. But they would have been, as people view them, as unapproachable and certainly untamable. But just how is it that creationists can possibly believe that dinosaurs and humans once lived on this earth together at the same time? Well, whether you believe it or not, we're going to show you some evidence that says they did. To begin with, dinosaurs did not start out as meat eaters. In fact, all creatures, even man, began in this life as vegetarians. We talked about that last week. I'll give you the references now. It was not until after the flood that God changed the rules about meat eating and that the fear of man was put in the animals. Notice this, Genesis 1:29. Then God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth and every tree which has fruit-bearing seed, yielding seed, and it shall be food for you. He's talking to man here. And to every beast on the earth, every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth which has life, I've given every green plant for food. So even dinosaurs, before the flood, ate veggies. Also, after the flood, this is God talking to Noah. He says, the fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky. With everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea, into your hand they are given. So it wasn't that man was running around away from these big things because they were afraid of them. The fear was put into the beast to flee from man. So that kind of helps. Yeah, this is one of those things where scientists, they dig up the bones and all they got is a bone. In fact, it's not even a bone, really. And they're looking at this, and they're shaping not only how the thing looks, and you know, speculate on what its environment is and what its behavior patterns are. You know, it's all supposition. Whereas God is telling you exactly the way the conditions were. Further, the Bible instructs us that many early men were of gigantic proportions. The stature and formidable nature of the Anakim was almost proverbial, for they were taken as a standard of comparison to stress the size of such peoples as the Imin, Deuteronomy 2:10, and the Raphite, Deuteronomy 2:21. Even the Nephilim, who were also claimed as sons of the Anakim, made the Israelite spies seem like grasshoppers. Numbers 13:33. Goliath was impressive at 6 cubits in a span, that is, 9 feet 9 inches, for Samuel 17:4. Yet Og, the king of Bashan, and the last of the Rephaim, Deuteronomy 3:11, possibly exceeded 12 feet. Because his bed, they said, was like 16 cubits. Is that right? 9 cubits, measured 9 cubits. So some of these people were twice as tall as I am. And muscled accordingly. Man also had been a clever hunter and killer even before the flood. Tubal-Cain was known as a forger of all implements of bronze and iron. That is a technology, the making of iron, that was lost in the flood. The technology of producing iron implements was not apparent in the archaeological records until the digging up of the tomb of Tutankhamun, where they found ceremonial daggers, one of gold and one of iron. And the iron one was worth more than the gold because, you know, the new technology that came out. Lamech in Genesis 4, known as a killer of men, the first one of those. The Nephilim were also on the earth in those days, along with mighty men of renown, robbers, you know, general killers, whatever, the way the term goes in some places. After the flood, men like Nimrod were mighty hunters and began to build cities and put together kingdoms. So where the scientists visioned, you know, cavemen running around, after the flood, you have men like Nimrod building, you know, the centers of Babylon and Nineveh. They're putting up walled cities as protection against any beasts that are out there. So they're not totally defenseless. Some early methods of hunting were very effective, like the use of stakes, pits, hamstringing, running up behind the animal, even the big ones, and, you know, cutting the tendons of the back of the legs so the thing couldn't walk, or stampeding over cliffs or into bogs. If you go to La Brea Tar Pits, you'll find, you know, they got a lot of skeletons out of the bog pits there. Even animals, you know, hunted that way. You know, the pictures of the saber tooth driving the mammoths into the tar pits and then jumping on them and feeding. Fire was also an early and useful weapon, along with using tamed animals against more ferocious ones. That's been an old custom. Elephants against, you know, hunting tigers. And I thought you might be interested. Note, you know, man was kind of clever. You know, note this method used by the Indians in Florida. This is circa 1560 something or other. How they hunted the giant alligators in the Everglades. I thought this was unique. You know, get six guys together with a pole and just shove it down the gullet of this big beast, and it can't move. I hadn't even thought of this, but this is what they were doing. Or if you notice the top picture, yeah, they're like a leviathan. The top scales are like armor, and you can't penetrate them. But flip that guy over, and now you got a soft belly and neck, and they're going at him with, you know, arrows and spears, and yeah. Man finds a way to hunt these things, no matter how big they are. It is speculated by some scientists that it's not a question of man fearing the monsters, but on the other way around. In fact, it might be the demise. I know Dr. Harab, you know, surmises that it wasn't some comet over in Russia that, you know, killed off everything, which, you know, to get something that big to cause a global disaster, you know, would have taken more than, you know, one impact, but just that man hunted like he does now, thanks to extinction, including the dinosaurs. I mean, you take down one brontosaurus, and that's a lot of meat for the tribe for a while. Okay, evidence is for a shorter lifetime. More and more evidence is compiling, showing that man indeed coexists with dinosaurs. Microscopist Mark Harmitage, I think I mentioned him a few weeks ago, since the 1960s has been studying the soft tissue found in a Triceratops horn. Now, if this animal died off 60 million years ago, there would be no soft tissue in the horn. In fact, he and others are also studying dinosaur DNA found in some bones. Okay. The amount of millions of years, there'd not be any DNA. The half-life of DNA is 5,000 years. Okay. So that means the most it could be is 10,000. So dinosaur DNA doesn't go back that far. In fact, it's only accurate probably in the testing of it up to 5,000 years. After that, it gets a little iffy. What has been suppressed has recently been proclaimed online. I mean, this stuff has been known since the 1960s. In fact, Armitage, who was a leading professor at the university, when he started bringing this stuff out and talking about it, they fired him because it didn't go along with the dinosaur pattern. But like 2 weeks ago online, there was all sorts of scientists from Europe that were spilling the same stuff. Okay, so it's making its way out there. Do I have something else to talk about here? No, okay, that was it. You're going the wrong way. In the Bible, in some other older works, the prophet Isaiah mentions still another phenomenal apparition, where he says, "Do not rejoice, O Philistia, all of you, because the rod that struck you is broken. For from the serpent's root, a viper will come out, and its fruit will be a flying serpent." So there were flying snakes around, you know, at the time of Philistia, Isaiah 14. And it goes also in Isaiah 30, the oracle concerning the beasts of the Negev. Through the land of distress and anguish, from where come lioness and lion, viper, and flying serpent. So a flying serpent is known in the Old Testament. But not just there. The Greek historian Herodotus in 450 B.C. wrote, "There is a place in Arabia to which I went on hearing of some winged serpents. And when I arrived there, I saw bones and spines of serpents in such quantities as would be impossible to describe. The form of the serpent is like that of a water snake, but he has wings without feathers and is like as possible to the wings of a bat." So wings without feathers, more like membrane. Josephus, the Jewish historian, you might take this a little bit grain of salt, but he's just going along with what the Bible and Herodotus said, as that Moses and the Israelites ventured upon the ground that was difficult to pass over because of the multitude of serpents, which it produces in vast numbers, some of which ascend out of the ground unseen and also fly in the air. In the muddy bottom of the Paluxy River, this came out in a documentary about the 1970s, I can remember seeing it. Give you a little background to this. There was a professor, you know, this is in Texas, Glenn Rose, and he went to the Paluxy, and he met a guy there who was selling odds and ends, and he had this little clay impression, and he had it labeled as a souvenir to sell, the big man print. And so the professor was kind of interested. He said, "Where'd you get this?" He goes, "Just over in the shallows of the river." And he says, "Can you show me?" So he took the professor out, and they went wading out into the water, and he showed him the hole in the bottom of the river where he dug the print out. And so the professor was fascinated, so he went back and got some of his students from the college, and they went up and they dammed parts of the Paluxy and diverted the water so they could study the bed of the river. Well, when they did that, this picture is kind of what they saw. There are not only the big man prints, but also human prints and dinosaur prints all over the place. And at one point, it looks like the dinosaur footprints and the man tracks are converging, but it goes into the bank of the river. So they brought out, you know, some heavy equipment, and they flipped the bank up, you know, strata untouched. And sure enough, it shows the prints of the man stepping right on the print of the dinosaur. And remember the document, they got all these scientists out there, and they're asking creationists, you know, what does that look like to you? It looks like dinosaurs and man were contemporary. You know, and they asked the evolutionist, the guy goes, well, if it wasn't for our chart showing that dinosaurs died out, you know, a million years before man, we kind of, you know, looks like man, you know, was contemporary with dinosaurs, but it can't be true. You know, it only looks like a human print. So anyway, that's what came out of the Paluxy. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen, it's been on TV, The 13th Warrior with Antonio Banderas. Okay, now, it's from a book by Michael Crichton. And when Crichton's early works, he mostly just did research into other works. So, you know, in his first book that he put out, Five Cases, it was from his own life because he used to be a doctor. You know, this is why he wrote for the TV series ER before he got into other things. So he wrote about that, and then he wrote about the big train robbery. So he researched, you know, that, made it for the movie. But in this book, he called Eaters of the Dead, and it's just a translation of a manuscript written in 1000 AD by a Arab emissary, you know, who was in a convoy, and they were attacked by Vikings, of all things. And the Vikings took this guy north, farther than any probably Arab had ever been. And so he chronicles the things that he saw. And one of them, he talks about, we've seen a big sea monster, and Crichton says, well, it's probably, he just saw a whale, you know, in the voyage. But he also, in their encounter, in fact, the Eaters of the Dead weren't like in the movie, you know, people just dressed in bear suits. In the actual manuscript, it talks about men completely covered with hair that looked like Neanderthals. And Neanderthal roughly supposedly lived 25,000 years ago. But this Arab is saying, hey, we fought these guys 1,000 years ago. So again, the timelines begin to narrow. There have also been many USOs. And used to UFOs, you know, unidentified flying objects. Well, there's unidentified swimming objects too. Like this, there's a creature, possibly a plesiosaurus, discovered by Japanese fishermen in a bad state of decay. But the Japanese scientists are claiming there must have been, you know, more than one, because one could not exist by himself. Yeah. Which is a good argument for Nessie too. You know, there's got to be more than one Nessie if the thing does exist. Also, in 1915, this is during World War I. Now, this is went into the log of a German U-boat. They had attacked a British steamer, the Iberian, and sunk it. And when this thing started to go down in the North Sea, when that cold water hit that steam engine, it exploded. And this is from the report of not only the captain, with the conning tower officer who was standing next to him, the chief engineer, the navigator, and the helmsman, who reported seeing a 60-foot-long sea creature blown 70, 80 feet in the air because of this explosion. Couldn't find any remains of it afterwards, but that went into the official report. Also, at least 1,500 Inca burial stones dating from 500 to 1,500 A.D., note the dates, 500 to 1500. It's getting important. Now, how this occurred was there was a doctor down in, you know, South America, and for a reward for some of the services he'd done to this family, this farmer brought him an Incan burial stone. And he was looking at it and fascinated by it, so he went down and started trying to perch up more of it, and he came up with, you know, 3,500 of them. And they've been discovered with carvings of men coexisting with dinosaurs. They're mostly from Peru and were known by the conquistadors and reported on them. Now, we've got pictures of them. Okay, and it shows an Inca warrior here with a, looks like a big dragon, something like that. We can kind of pass that off. But these two, for me, are fascinating. Here's this big brontosaurus, and then looks like an allosaurus, and then some kind of flying reptile, and then a stegosaurus, and then a triceratops. In fact, over here, what you have is a triceratops being ridden by an Inca. Now, the pictures are pretty well done. You know, what the animals look like. Now, I told you, remember the days? When was the first dinosaur bone discovered? The first quarter of the 19th century, just before the Civil War. And two guys got in kind of a race to start collecting these things. They didn't know what the animals really were. I mean, nobody had used the term dinosaur. They kind of coined the terms. They didn't even know how the bones that they discovered went together. So some of the original, you know, views of the dinosaurs were kind of wrong and had to be corrected. But here's these Incas drawing exactly the way the things looked, at least we picture them now, 1,000 years before the first bones had been discovered. How did they know what they looked like? Unless they're riding them around. I mean, get a little lizard, raise it up as a pet, and you got a triceratops, you know, to ride around on with its own built-in armor plating, you know, for war. And there's not just a few of these. Like we said, there's thousands of them. Also, there are hundreds of figurines, you know, move north into Mexico that show accurate models of Jurassic creatures. Look, there's a guy hugging one. Okay. A lot of these figurines floating around, too. Yeah. Where do these people come up with this stuff? Unless they were living with them. Not only the dinosaur area, but the mammoth area has also been collapsing, you know, in shortness. John Bakeless, in his book, The American as Seen by Its First Explorers, it's a nice compilation of the early journals of explorers out there. And he analyzed a report by a simple sailor named David Ingram, who was being interrogated. And then I put this in here because this guy was interrogated by a really expert interrogator. He's the chief of Elizabeth's Secret Service. Okay. Now, Mr. Ingram was once of a company of Englishmen. I guess they'd been captured by a Spanish ship. I mean, the Spanish were in Florida before Jamestown, you know, before Europeans started, you know, colonizing the English, whatever. In fact, sometimes it's hard to wrap your mind around, but the Spanish were on the West Coast here 200 years before the first settlements in New England. Anyway, he was put ashore with 114 men. And they just started, well, we're stranded here. Let's walk across, you know, toward, you know, the Atlantic. And hopefully as we reach the coast, we can find, you know, some ships, you know, to sail back to England. Well, of the 114, only three made it. But in the interrogation, said three survived. One of the creatures he reported seeing was an elephant. Now, Bakeless believes that this man may have been the only white man who ever saw an American mammoth. Just finding an elephant in North America would have been astounding enough, but probably saw a mammoth. After all, 200 years later, Thomas Jefferson was assured by Indians that mammoths still survived in the interior. For many years, people who believed in evolution have tried to use dinosaurs to convince people that evolution is true. Unfortunately, they're running out of time and space. Our timelines are collapsing. And the geologists are showing that, It wouldn't have taken millions of years for the Grand Canyon to form. It could have been done in a matter of 10 years, given the right sediments and the right, bursting of, flood waters from a big reservoir in the north, whatever. According to them, dinosaurs evolved and became extinct millions of years before humans existed. There's no evidence to that. I mean, you can't come up with evidence to that. Yeah, it's a hypothesis that's unprovable. However, what we've done is just look, at a plethora of all sorts of evidence that's starting to, and keeps piling up that, man and dinosaurs live contemporary. In fact, the Christian should have confidence in his Bible that, the creation record is accurate and gives us a very accurate look at early time on this earth. Whereas, the evolutionists, they kind of speculate on even what the world was like. And they have no idea. Rather than showing the truth of evolution, dinosaurs represent the awesome power and craft of the Creator and the ability He put into man to dominate and rule his environment. Might say for good or bad. The planet is in His care. Okay? So we can bring it into proper use as God intended. We can take our science and use it for edifying reasons, or we can turn it on ourselves. In fact, it comes down into what Job said, now I ask you, but now ask the beasts and let them teach you. It's like the same as, behold, the heavens declare the glory of God. And they do. I mean, the more we get into outer space, the more we see the power that's out there in the distance, the more you have to speculate on just how great and glorious and powerful and wise God must be in order to come up with it all, especially to speak in existence instantaneously. Yeah, it's hard to think about. But if you find it hard to wrap your mind around it, this is what Job is saying. Ask the beasts, let them teach you. The birds of the heaven, let them tell you. Or speak to the earth. How do you speak to the earth? Dig down a little ways. It'll talk to you. Tells you about civilizations are there. At one point, men ridiculed the Bible because it talked about Hittites. Man, they hadn't discovered anything about Hittite. They're just talking through their mouth. The Bible didn't know what it's talking about. We now know more about Hittites than any other civilization. In fact, what we know, and you can see in Time Life books now, there were two Hittite civilizations, which would explain a lot by Abraham's trading with them. But let it teach you. Let the fish of the sea declare to you. The earth can teach you all these things. Is God true? The Bible true? Or creationists? Just look at the fossil records. Darwin hoped the fossil records would show us that there's been all sorts of evolution going on. But the fossil records show creation's right. There's no transition skeletons. In fact, I worked with a guy who used to do illustrations for museums. And he got really arguing about, he says, you only see what's up in the museum, down below in the vaults. There's all sorts of bones. Thousands and thousands of bones. And I asked him one little question. I said, is there any transition bones? I mean, you've got this and you've got this. Do you have any bones showing anything happening in between? And it's like I struck him between the eyes with a 2x4 because he stopped, he thought about it, his eyes glazed over, and he began to be more malleable in talking after that, because it's a truth. You can trust in the scriptures. Our big problem is, though, now that we've basically conquered our worlds around us in time. You know, there's some things that need to be addressed, like where are we going to get the water for the next 20 years. There are bigger and more ferocious beasts than those that walk the planet. The worst thing that we're going to encounter, in fact, how did Pogo put it? We've met the enemy and they is us. James puts it this way. Be careful of being two-souled. That is, where there's actually two things living inside of you. Paul addresses it, I think, in Romans 7. You know, where you get to the point where there's things you want to do that are right, but there's another nature inside of you that makes you do what's wrong. You know, a law of the spirit, a law of the flesh. And what God is trying to do is help us harness our own selves. Because too often we are two-souled. You know, we are easily conquered by our worldly self. Yeah, it's not the devil made us do it. God conquered him a long time ago. Okay. What we have to contend with is just the minions of Satan. You know, a lot of times what that ends up being is our fellow man or even us. And this is what we struggle against, you know, ourselves, the worldliness that's been bred inside of us. And often, you know, it can well up. You know, we think things we shouldn't, we say things we shouldn't, we do things we shouldn't. And in fact, I found out with myself, you sit there and go, no, don't do that, don't say that, you know, you're going to regret it, da-da-da-da, and then you do it anyway. And you go, just, what happened? Well, if you don't exercise enough of the spirit that God talks about, you know, of letting yourself be transformed and renewed by the Word of God, you're not going to have the power to resist. You're not going to have the will. What you need is God's will in your lives. That's the only way you're going to defeat the biggest monsters that there are. And this is what we're called for. With the song we're about to sing, 269, There's a Fountain Free. I mean, this is what God is talking about. You know, a fountain of living water welling up inside of you. This is what Jesus taught, you know, to the woman at the well. That God can put inside of you a living spirit, something that gets stronger and stronger and wells up when you need it in order to overcome the problems in life. And this is the whole process of Christianity, of taking on this new nature and strengthening, you know, the spiritual side of you against the fleshly side. So that hopefully after a while, the flesh is not there. In fact, what Peter says, we actually purify ourselves by obedience to the truth. You can totally get rid of it and be Christ-like, you know, fully in nature. By turning yourself over to God's will, to really knowing what the scriptures teach and obeying God by acting it out. If there's anything we can do to help, please let us know as we stand to sing.